I was. As of yesterday. Anchorage.
Vacation?
No. Board meeting for WISN.
Okay.
And also up to the Northern Slope. You've been up there?
I haven't. I haven't been to Alaska at all yet.
You gotta get up there.
I know.
The Northern Slope is at the end of nowhere.
Yeah, my in-laws are going on a cruise in August.
Yeah. It's great. It's beautiful. Good morning, everyone.
Morning, Chief.
In order to make sure we do due diligence to respecting your time, we're going to go ahead and get started. As you probably know, if you didn't get the email, just in case, Darren is out sick today, and Chris is on a business trip. So we have wonderful staff, as usual, to help guide us through this meeting process. So let's go around the room, and we'll do some introductions. So, Pat, we'll start with you on the end.
Pat Kohler, Director of Licensing.
So my name is Martin Mueller. I'm the Assistant Secretary for Health Systems Quality Assurance at the Department of Health here for Secretary Leeson.
I'm Mike Dornfeld. I'm with the DOT Traffic Operations Office. I'm representing Secretary Peterson today.
Okay. I'm John Batiste, Chief of the State Patrol, and I have the honor of being your meeting chair today.
Jim Swanger, representing the judiciary.
Kim Kimbler with OSPI, representing Randy Dorn, who is represented by my director, Alan Jones, who's not here.
And I'm Stacey Hoff, manager of the Research and Data Division here at Traffic Safety Commission, sitting in for Director Grundell.
I'm Jerry Nelson with the Traffic Safety Commission.
I'm Jonna Van Dyke. I'm a program manager with the Traffic Safety Commission.
Go around the wall.
I'm Marsha Masters. I'm the Target Zero Manager of Kitsap County.
And Dave Wright, Target Zero Manager, Whatcom County.
Evelyn Wright, Target Zero Manager for Schlein-Levels.
Michelle Baumgart, Target Zero Manager for Mason County.
Marion Swenson, Target Zero Manager for Clark County.
Assistant Chief Ron Rupp, State Patrol in charge of Global Operations.
MJ Hott, Program Manager, Traffic Safety.
Mark McDowell with the Traffic Safety Commission, Program Manager.
Kim Smith, Target Zero Manager for Tass County.
Doris Fed, I'm not.
Division
Specialist,
Traffic Safety Commission.
Erica
Simon, Communications Consultant, Traffic Safety Commission.
Terry Novello, Target Zero for Thurston County.
Shelley Baldwin, Traffic Safety Commission, Program Manager.
All right, do we have anyone on the phone?
Yeah, I got John Snyder here, Spokane City Council. I can sort of hear everybody, but not too bad.
Okay, we'll be sure and speak up. Anyone else? Okay, I think we have a quorum as well, so we'll go ahead and get started. Hopefully all of you have had an opportunity to review the minutes. If not, we can take some time to do so. Everyone's ready to approve the minutes. Any recommended changes to the minutes? Okay, I hear a motion to accept the minutes.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All right. Any opposed? All right. The ayes have it. Well, the minutes are approved. Jonna, the Pride Roadside Survey update.
All right, Chief. Thank you. I'm Jonna Van Dyke. I'm a program manager with the Traffic Safety Commission, and I'd also like to just add that we were just joined by Gloria Mansfield Averill, who is our Target Zero manager from Pierce County. Oh. Welcome, Gloria, too. Can you hear me there in Spokane?
Just barely, yes.
Just barely. Should I move this microphone over a little closer to me?
Would that? That's just strictly
you
phone.
You could probably move the phone over closer to you, John.
Where? I don't see a phone.
Oh, it's in the middle.
Oh, that. Okay. Let's do that.
All right.
Whoa. Timber. All right. Is that a little better?
Yeah, that's great.
Perfect. Okay. So what I'd like to start with, I'm going to talk about the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation study, and I'd like to start with a little video that was developed, and Chief, my apologies to you, I know you've already seen this, it's only 3 minutes long, but it'll give us an idea of what the project looks like, what the data collection looks like, and then I'll, since the data collection has already taken place, I'll tell you a little bit about what we found with it. So.
The Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation, or PIRE, a prominent research organization based in Maryland, will be conducting a roadside survey of driver, drug, and alcohol use in Washington during the summer months of 2014. This video provides an overview of the project to explain for motorists what is involved. First and foremost, participation in the survey is completely voluntary and anonymous. Drivers are offered a stipend of up to $60 for their participation in the survey, which takes about 20 minutes. A driver is always free to leave if he decides to stop participating, even in the middle of the survey. The survey crew will approach drivers when they are stopped at intersections. Highly visible signs will alert drivers as they approach the intersection that a voluntary roadside survey is taking place. If a driver is interested in participating in the survey, they will be guided into the designated survey bays. Surveys will take place during the day and at night in 6 Washington counties across the state and at 5 separate locations within each of those counties to provide a representative sample of the driving population. People who volunteer to participate in the roadside survey will be asked questions about their driving behavior, including questions relating to drug and alcohol use patterns, and asked to provide a voluntary, anonymous breath alcohol test. If they volunteer to do so, motorists will also provide both a saliva and blood sample. The survey will show how many drivers have alcohol in their systems, drugs, over-the-counter, prescription, and illegal drugs, and the combination of alcohol and drugs. A follow-up survey will examine changes in alcohol and drug use after marijuana becomes legally available. Over the years, progress has been made in the battle against impaired driving. Still, impaired driving kills about 200 people each year in Washington State alone, and it is a difficult problem to combat. In other states where the roadside surveys have been conducted, surveyors had no trouble persuading motorists to participate, given the $60 stipend. However, motorists who just show up and volunteer to do the survey cannot participate because, from a research standpoint, it's important that participants are randomly selected. Participation in the survey is anonymous, and for that reason, drivers give consent verbally and also sign with an X rather than a signature. No names or license plate numbers are recorded. The Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation contracts with local law enforcement to provide security for the researchers and the public. Officers also advise the researchers, helping them find appropriate locations for the survey work and ensuring that they don't impede traffic or create problems for the local residents with the data collection. It can be hard for a sober person to imagine why any drug or alcohol-impaired driver would volunteer to participate in a roadside survey, but it actually happens quite frequently, and PIRE researchers have a strict protocol for dealing with impaired drivers who drive into their survey operations. This is not an enforcement-focused operation. The aim of the survey is research. However, given impaired drivers' danger to themselves and other motorists, no one wants impaired drivers to be allowed to just drive away. The impaired drivers are given choices. Is there another sober driver in the car who could function as a designated driver? Choices include a free taxi ride home, a hotel, a tow truck, much better options than a DUI. And if the impaired driver doesn't opt for one of these easy choices offered by the researchers, the law enforcement officer, who is working overtime and paid by PIRE, is called over to go over the choices again. Researchers say it's amazing how persuasive the law enforcement are when it comes to reviewing the choices. Since 1996, there have been more than 30,000 motorists interviewed by PIRE roadside researchers, and not one motorist has received a DUI from this research work. At the end of the research project, PIRE will develop a report which will be available to anyone via the Washington Traffic Safety Commission and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. PIRE's website contains reports on the 2007 National Roadside Survey, which gives much more detail about their data collection work. citizens are encouraged to contact PIER or the Washington Traffic Safety Commission in Olympia for more information.
So that gives you an idea what the PIER project looks like. Thank you, MJ. And thinking back on where I was at the beginning of this project, I'll tell you, if there were an award for naivete, I'd get the Olympic gold medal for it, because really early on, what we were talking about in terms of the procedures that we would use to collect this data would not work. But because we have great partnerships with law enforcement, and we have our traffic safety resource prosecutors and others who gave us feedback on the ideas as they were, you know, cooking along, we were able to come to some solutions about how we would collect the data in a way that would work. There was a meeting that took place February 18th with our law enforcement partners and our traffic safety resource prosecutors, our folks from NHTSA, the director of research from the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation, and even the head of behavioral research from NHTSA. And that was really a pretty pivotal meeting where we just duked it out and said, all right, unless we can come to some kind of agreement about what's going to work here, we really can't move forward with this project. You might think, you know, just collecting data is a real no-brainer and what could go wrong, right? But as we all know, there's an element in our society that mistrusts anything done by government and thinks that it's really just a ruse for something much more sinister. And probably that same element doesn't trust law enforcement either. So, yeah, get the two together, and really a project like this is kind of like waving a big red flag in front of a bull. So what you see there with this video shows what the research looked like in the for the motorist. The first point of contact was the PIER researcher who, you know, was positioned at a busy intersection with that sign that said voluntary roadside survey. And we really emphasized that it was voluntary every step of the way. Voluntary, even if you agreed to do the survey and changed your mind once you were in that bay. So also, one of the other things that we insisted upon for doing this survey was a public information project that preceded the data collection. And, you know, I'm going to send around the samples of the media coverage. Jerry, can I hand that to you and just send that around there? This gave us an opportunity to get before the media before the project took place. But with the publicity, it's bound to impact the research. So instead of the researchers coming up to people who knew nothing about this research, now they were coming up to people who had heard about it on the news. Now, they want a random sample when they collect this data. So if somebody, and this happened, if somebody said, hey, I'm going to go do this research work, I want to get $60, that would help my budget. And they sought out the research, the researchers would say, no, they call this a self-select. And people, you know, they want to be able to just pull them out of the flow of traffic. However, because of the publicity effort, just about everybody they talked to had heard about the project. So if they eliminated everybody who had heard about the project, they would have eliminated everybody. It did affect, to some extent, what they were doing. So basically, the data collection took place in these areas and on these dates. The first 3 weeks of June, starting in Spokane, we have our TZM, our Target Zero Manager in Spokane, to thank for handling the media over there in Spokane, and Shelley to thank for handling the media in Yakima. I was at my nephew's graduation on Whidbey Island that weekend, and that was mandatory for me. That wasn't optional. So, but everything went well. The following weekend, King and Snohomish, the third weekend, Kitsap and Whatcom. The outreach effort was a first for the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation, although they told me that they could see the logic in doing this, and they were restricted by NHTSA. Now, they're working on contract for NHTSA. But if you don't get out there and tell people what you're doing and why you're doing it, then the people that oppose whatever it is you're doing or think it's a ruse for something much more sinister and sometimes get the ear of the media, and that can result in bad publicity, and has in other states. In fact, not only was there bad publicity in other states, the publicity went national. So, you know, it was a real uphill battle for some of these other areas. Also, doing the publicity with this research data collection was an evolving process. We had to ask the media for a favor. And the favor was, you know, we're doing this data collection. Please don't go to the data collection site and shoot your video or take your pictures. Because we're telling people it's voluntary and we're telling them it's anonymous. And it's not anonymous if you've got a King TV camera in your face. Asking the media for a favor is kind of a little bit of a challenging thing to do because also these are public sites. They have every right to be there. And you know what that's like. So our agreement with them was we'll set up a mock situation here where you and your reporter can go through, you can videotape, you can take pictures, you can experience going through the survey. And we can do that. And if we do that for you, would you do this for us? Would you please not take people's pictures going through this research? And I'm frankly amazed they all cooperated. We had 100% cooperation from the media on this. The downside of that was it was a lot more work. It was work for those of us who had to go there and do the interviews and whatnot. PIER was not able to do interviews. NHTSA was not able to do interviews. So it fell to us and the TZMs. And it was more work, and it was also more work for the PIER researchers. They had to, you know, set up and take the media through the interviews, so they got less sleep. They come in here on Thursday, they identify those locations, and in each of the counties where they do this research work, they collect data at 5 locations within each county. So they're just working around the clock. They're collecting during the day, they're collecting at night, they're collecting late at night. The first go-round in Spokane, the agreements were all set in place, and then PIER kind of backed out, and the media were there. It didn't result in negative publicity for us, but it did result in some hurt feelings among the news media. So I can't say it was a flawless process, but we did get complete positive media coverage on the project, unless you count High Times magazine. Now, that's a magazine for marijuana users, written by marijuana users, and that's not mainstream media, and I'm not going to worry too much about it. The other thing is, as you know, reading news reports, nowadays with social media, if there's a story in the Olympian, for example, there's also public comments after the story. And that's, you know, something to digest for anybody on any project. But here, at least, we had people commenting back and saying, you know, of course, the sort of fringe elements were saying, well, you know, this is, you know, don't do this. Whatever you do, don't do this. Don't give me your DNA. You don't know what they're going to do with your DNA. And other people saying, you know, actually, I went through it and it was fine. And I think you're overreacting. So we had people defending the project among the public. So the outreach effort did impact the data collection in ways that, you know, as I mentioned, a lot of drivers said they'd heard about it. We heard back from PIER that more people went through the survey. They had an easier time talking people into doing the survey because they'd already heard about it in the news. They knew it was legitimate and not just some, you know, operation of people who were identity thieves who were going to, you know, steal your identity. They knew it was legitimate research backed by government, legitimate government agencies. So they had more people actually volunteering to do the research and going all the way through the process, complete with saliva samples and blood draws. That's going to be helpful for us when we, you know, finally get this data. And as I mentioned, the researchers got less sleep because they had to work this media. They had to do this media work in addition to everything else they were doing. For all of us, it was really just a learning experience. So, moving forward, PIER will compile all of this data for us. They're collecting data on, you know, our drivers, cross representative sample, how many have alcohol in their system, how many have drugs in their system, legal drugs, illegal drugs, over-the-counter drugs, 75 different classifications of drugs, and of course, as we all know, the combination of alcohol and drugs. So it'll give us a great snapshot of what's going on out there with respect to our drivers and impairment. As we all know, impaired driving is still the number one cause of fatal collisions here in Washington, despite all the great work by all these great people in this room and elsewhere. It's still a big problem. It's still a big nut to crack. And without the data that really tells us where we are, particularly with the legalization of marijuana, we'd be in a tougher position. So we've got the data collected. We expect to have some numbers by September, we're hoping. We're keeping our fingers crossed on that. And they will be back to collect more data probably at about the beginning of next year. They said 6 months after the first data collection, they'll be back to do this again. Well, we'll know a lot more about how to do this in Washington in a way that's, you know, not going to create ruffles among the public or unhappy customers among our motoring public, or problems for our law enforcement participants. I think we learned a lot in the process of doing this data collection that we can apply in the next go-round. I think, by and large, we had a pretty smooth process, not completely flawless. One time I was heading up to Burien to meet the media up there, Seattle Times TV crew, and I was just noticing how nice it was to think, if they don't show up, that's okay. I don't have to have them show up. Whereas, you know, when you do media events and things like that, you're always thinking, oh, if they don't show up, it's all this work for nothing. Now I was thinking, if they don't show up, that's great. That's just great. I'm going to go home on Saturday. And so I got up there. Well, they did show up, and they were 20 minutes early, and the survey crew didn't show up. And then I was really sweating it. Well, the survey crew showed up like 20 minutes late when the TV crew finally got their coverage, and everything worked out. We did have another situation. In fact, it was in the Burien White Center area, and that very time where, you know, I went up to the law enforcement who were providing, from the King County Sheriff's Office, who were providing security for our researchers, and I said, you know, I really hope this is the easiest overtime you ever work in your life. I just hope it's so easy. And I remember the look they gave me. You know, these are a couple of real buff, you know, can take on anything kind of officers, and they were giving me this kind of funny look, and I thought, well, you know, whatever. Anyway, well, that night, when they were collecting data in some pretty sketchy areas of Seattle between 1 and 3 o'clock in the morning, on one side of their data collection, they had the law enforcement officers dealing with a severely mentally ill person who was in the throes of a psychotic episode, and there were two officers there helping the research crew, and, you know, that was fantastic. What they didn't know, because they weren't told, was that on the other side of the data collection, there were gang members brandishing their weapons to the researchers. And if the researchers would have told the research manager at that time that this was going on, they would have shut it down and, you know, picked another site and may do, because the security of the officers, the security of the researchers, the security of the public, these are all first priorities for this operation. They weren't told, and so they tightened up their procedures after that. But for some of the officers, providing security for the researchers was not a small job. Now, you know, in some places like the outside the Kids at Mall, that was a real small job because, you know, there weren't any problems at all. But in some of the places and during some of the times, it was an assignment where they really had to earn their money. So anyway, we will be back with another report when we get our data, and that's our report for now. Any questions?
Questions, comments?
Jonah, when is the next go-around of data collection?
Data collection next time is probably about January of 2015, so early next year.
We did have two phone calls come into my cell phone with people looking to find out where the fire people were going to have their Whatcom County location so they could go participate.
Oh, that's funny. And, you know,
I very gladly said, you know, I don't know where they're going to do those at.
I actually, when I was doing a media interview, and where was that? I believe that was in Kitsap, had a woman pull into the parking lot and say, is this where they're doing that data collection? Because I want to pay $60. So, you know what? That's a whole lot better than people saying they're collecting our DNA, and, you know, that's not okay.
John, did you get any idea whether we had more people than other sites they've been in other states that may
yes.
have to provide an alternative means to get home to their repair?
Well, I was interested in how many people they actually had to deal with that were DUI, that pulled into the site. I am estimating about 6 or 7. I talked with a research manager about that yesterday, and he said he didn't have the firm numbers yet. And I said, with all of the data that you collected in the state of Washington, that seems like a very small number to me. He said, we don't really talk about this publicly too much, but it isn't always easy to spot impairment, especially when it's marijuana or drug impairment, and I'm sure you notice that too, even with your officers. But we'll get some firm numbers there. As for the overall number of people that went through the survey, because of the publicity effort, they had way more people going through. They actually had to increase the number of phlebotomists they had at the survey sites to accommodate all the people that wanted to go through. And in Spokane, where they didn't exactly, well, they didn't pick their favorite site for doing the data collection, they had 2 entry points. And that created a problem that first weekend because it was a backup of people who were there. And so people were willing to come in and do this, even willing to wait up to an hour to do this, which after, you know, the Spokane data collection, they said, let's regroup. That's not okay. Let's figure this one out. That's a problem. So, Karen, I'm not aware of any complaints that went into our TZM over there in Spokane. But I'm sure we would have had complaints if that would have continued. So there were a few bugs.
Hey, John, this is John on the phone here.
Yeah, John.
I just want to say I represent a lot of those people that have no trust in the government whatsoever over here in Spokane. And we didn't hear any complaints.
Oh.
So to me, that's a good indication that that things were handled pretty well. I was surprised at how it went pretty under the radar. And so hats off.
Thank you. That's great. Great news.
John, I want to say great work by you and the staff who had a hand in coordinating this. You know, I was one of those very skeptical persons about this approach. Very interested in the data outcome, but very skeptical in terms of the approach because of the negative feedback, the fallout that occurred across the country, being in close contact with chiefs around the country and the reaction they got from their communities brought about a concern. The educational effort that was put forth and the stakeholder work, bar none, it was great.
Thank you, Chief.
I think that really made a difference, and I appreciate that.
Thank you.
We're looking forward to the data.
Well, we appreciate all the input your officers and staff gave us to help us figure out what potholes in the road we needed to avoid. So.
Great work.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, MJ, you're up.
I was asked to tell you about the Tribal Traffic Safety Advisory Board. So that's what I'm going to do. And you should have in your packets a handout that tells us why we need to be working with the tribes. You can see that when it comes to fatality rates with the Native American population, we're going in the wrong direction. So first today, I'm going to give you a 30,000-foot view of tribes in Washington. I'm wondering how many of you in here have worked pretty extensively with tribes? Okay, good. So for those of you who are not familiar, in Washington, we have 29 federally recognized tribes. Most states that have tribes tend to have, like 1 to 5, with notable exceptions like Alaska and California, but the usual is more like 1 to 5 range. Each tribe is a sovereign nation with their own laws. So that means that the Lummi laws are different from the Quinault laws. So we got 29 sets of laws in this state on top of the state laws. So a reservation may or may not have a seatbelt law. And it's kind of hard to do high visibility enforcement when there's no law to enforce. Tribes' histories can be very different. And a tribe might get along real well with this tribe over here and not get along at all with some tribe over here. And when it comes to federal laws, Washington is what's called a mixed state. So some tribes work under this public law, some work under this public law, and it gets even more complex than that. Particularly when it comes to enforcement jurisdiction between tribes and state and counties. In fact, there's a lot of case law that comes out of enforcement jurisdiction lawsuits in civil court. So it's no surprise that when we're looking at traffic safety culture, we have a huge range among those 29 states. And for example, some tribes actually give grants to the Washington State Patrol for the work the State Patrol does for them on their reservation. Other tribes don't really want to have that much to do with State Patrol. Now, also in Washington, each state agency by statute has a tribal liaison. Here, that's me. And that person is to report to the head of the agency. And I became the tribal liaison. It's actually coming on close to 2 years, which kind of freaked me out that it's been that long. And at first, I did a lot of stumbling around. At times, I felt like I was crossing a minefield on a night with no moon. Fortunately, sometimes when I'd be reaching out there, someone would grab my hand and say, "Oh, you want to come this way, not that way." So I got traction in some places, and I got no traction in some places. But now we have a very enthusiastic and energized Tribal Traffic Safety Advisory Board. And the way that we got them was we sent out a letter to the 29 chairs, and we asked for volunteers who would make a commitment to quarterly meetings and come from the area, the four E's of traffic safety, plus tribal leadership. And at our first meeting, the members were vehemently on board about needing the four E's of traffic safety and tribal leadership. Totally agreed with that, but they were not on board with quarterly meetings. That wasn't going to work. We needed monthly meetings. We needed those monthly meetings to build and maintain momentum. They also wanted more tribes to be on the board to get broader buy-in and commitment around the state. So during that meeting, Darren and I kept looking at each other, and our eyes were wide, like, wow, this is great. We were amazed at this enthusiasm, very pleased. So we sent out a second letter. And right now, including Darren and myself, we have 12 primaries and 2 secondaries to back up. And the board is co-chaired by Darren Grundell, our director, and Celine Cloquet, who is on the Cowlitz Tribes Executive Committee. And as of today, in addition to, we have the director of the Governor's Office of Indian Affairs, many of you know Craig Bill, and the, I would say, primary tribal liaison from WashDOT, Megan Cotton. I'm kind of blown away by what we've got in terms of tribal enforcement, because I thought we weren't going to be able to get many, but we have. The chief of police for Chehalis Tribe, an officer from Lower Elwha, the interim chief of police of Port Gamble Sklallam, chief of police of Soxhawabo, chief of police Swinomish, chief of police Squaxin Island, and a retired chief of police Yakima Nation, Ken Hoptuit. And they've been so helpful, answered all kinds of dumb questions. When it comes to engineering and planning, we have the Confederated Tribes of the Colville Reservation and the Muckleshoot Indian Tribe. And we are working to get more tribal leadership, and also we want to get health on board. EMS is challenging because very few tribes have their own emergency medical services, but with the police chief from Soxhawatl, he's been a certified EMT for many years, and he chairs the National Tribal Emergency Management Council. So we're going to get in that perspective. But this group has been a great sounding board on what is effective and what is not effective. So they've also helped us with updating our Centennial Accord Plan, which right now is out for consultation. For those of you who don't know, anytime you have an agreement with the tribes, it must go through this process of consultation with each tribe. They helped us with editing a scope of work on what will be a 2015 project with Eastern Washington University. In fact, two board members have degrees in tribal planning from Eastern, and the professors that they had for those classes are the ones who have the project agreement. So we got inside information. The board told us about the Evergreen Tribal MPA program, a master's in tribal public administration, and it looks like we're going to have one of our board members is going to do a project when he's working on his master's, because he is being encouraged by his tribal council to get his master's. Some members right now have started outreach to the tribal law enforcement who are not on the board, making some one-on-one phone calls with them. And the board is helping with something at which I failed miserably, and that is we wanted to have, Darren and I would go on a listening tour, and I came up with no meetings after many phone calls, many hours. But they're now reaching out and helping us with that. If for those of you who don't know, Governor Inslee has made a very strong commitment with tribes, and he is visiting each of the 29 tribes, and I think he may be more than halfway through those visits. So he is doing some serious outreach there. But every month at every meeting, something comes up in the discussions where you see new synergies happening just among the members of this board. And starting October 1, the board will have some money, about $40,000 to work with. So it's nothing on the scope of the WIDAC, but they will be able to make some decisions and do some work on behalf of the commission to change tribal cultures. So to interweave a traffic safety culture into their local tribal community culture. Because when you go back to that handout, that's what it's all about. We don't need to just change behaviors in this situation. We've got to change a culture. And that's it. Thank you.
Questions, comments? Great report.
John,
go ahead.
For MJ?
Uh-huh.
So, MJ, quick questions. Can I assume that the pedestrian number cited there includes cyclist fatalities as well?
No, this would be pedestrians.
Just pure pedestrians.
Yes.
Okay. And then the second question is, in Spokane we have 4 reservations within a very close distance of us, but we also have several thousand registered tribal members that live in the city of Spokane, about half from local tribes, half from probably out-of-state tribes. I'm assuming all these numbers are just for fatalities on reservation land. And if that's the case, is there any kind of stats out there for fatalities for tribal members off the reservation?
No, these numbers are for fatalities of Native Americans within the borders of Washington State. So,
okay, so it doesn't matter if it was on the reservation, it's anywhere in Washington State.
Correct.
Okay. Great. That's what I need to know. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Sunday, do they also get data involving non-tribal members that occur on the reservations?
Yes, but that's not going to be in the Native American numbers. The ethnicity and race is coming from the death certificates.
Correct. Okay.
So it's primarily what the family members, if they don't have, say, a membership card on them or, identification is coming from the family members.
But can we give each tribe, in terms of reservation, stats as a whole as to what's occurring on their reservation?
We know that they're Native American, but we don't know what tribe they are.
Okay. Yeah, it would be good if we could somehow get that information to draw them in terms of recognition of the importance of attacking what's happening on their reservation.
As the chief knows and a few others, data sharing with the tribes is on that widespread of how much they're into traffic safety. We get really good cooperation with some tribes and essentially no cooperation from others. So we know anecdotally that these numbers are way underreported.
I just want to say this can't be overemphasized in terms of the importance of the work and their willingness to come together with our attempts to get at Target Zero. It's impossible to accomplish without their participation. So
you got it.
That's admirable. Thanks. All right. Shelley. Technician airlock. Well, it says Shelley.
My agenda had Erica being first, but I've got an old agenda, obviously. So, Darren wanted me to brief you guys on what was happening with the Ignition Interlock revolving account that we use to support the Ignition Interlock program and pay for indigent people to get their interlocks. And Pat Kohler is here, so please feel free to jump in at any time. You've been very involved in the whole thing. So I think you all know the Ignition Interlock Indigent Account. We've had it since about 2008. It's a revolving account that's paid for out of people who have interlocks and are not indigent, have been paying an extra $20 a month into the account. And then people who are indigent can go to that account to apply for assistance to help with their interlocks. That system worked really, really well in Washington for a long time. Many other states watched their attempts at covering indigency go bankrupt very quickly. So it was the idea behind it, offenders paying into the account, offenders getting funds from the account, helps lower judicial inhibitions when they don't want to sentence somebody to something that's going to be a hardship for them financially. So helped, working really, really well until this year. A couple of things happened this year that caused the account to go upside down. One of them was an appropriation from the account to Department of Corrections to pay for contracts for chemical dependency beds. A great thing to pay for, but it left the account with a 2.2 basically hole in it. So the other thing that happened was the $20 fee and the indigency application was just being applied for the amount of time that they were suspended and driving on an ignition interlock driver's license. And then in 2012, we said, well, let's extend that to even their restriction. So there's kind of two phases of ignition interlock, and one is the driver's license that you get instead of being suspended. And then once that's up, you get a driver's license again, but it has a restriction on it for ignition interlock. So we extended it for that much longer period of time, a year, 5 years, 10 years for some people. And those two things combined had the account coming up short. So in July, DOL sent letters to all of the people that were using interlocks on indigency and told them that instead of covering 100%, as they had been doing since the start of it, they were going to be able to cover, I think, 11%. So it was about an $8 payment. So that has the potential to cause people to stop using interlock. And we know interlocks are very effective when they're installed, not very effective once they come off. So DOL and the governor's office and the state legislature worked together to try to resolve that issue. The resolution ended up being DOL using their own budget to fill that hole, hoping that when the legislature convenes again, their second supplemental budget will repay DOL for filling that hole. So Now, starting in August, we'll go back up to 100% payments. So that resolves this budget fiscal year's crisis for that account. But the remaining fact is, at this point, the account is taking in less money than it is putting out if it reimbursed at 100%. So moving forward, our projections are this will continue to be an issue. So Governor's Office asked Traffic Safety Commission to convene a group of stakeholders to discuss the issues around Interlock and the indigency account and make some recommendations to DOL. DOL has complete control over that account, up to the amount that they're given authority for, to decide, and they've managed it beautifully. But they don't want to arbitrarily come up and say, well, we're just going to cover 75% now. They want that stakeholder input to determine what steps we could take and what's logical. So that's where we are with the indigent, with the Interlock indigency account. We will be reaching out to stakeholders and convening a group meeting, probably shooting for a September time frame, making recommendations to DOL and perhaps recommendations for legislation to help that gap in whatever way the group feels is the necessary way to outreach.
So Shelley, I assume, Pat, the alternative modes of available dollars have been debated. MAP 21 as an example, in terms of dealing with behavioral issues, is there not an opportunity there?
MAP 21, so the hold was $2.2 million. MAP 21 gave us, for our first offender interlock law, $417,000.
Yeah.
And that is not here yet. That's part of our 2015, which was built into our DUI plan that you guys all voted on last time you were here. So that grant fund had already been, for 2015, is sorted out.
I would add that it's those two reasons are part of it. There also is growth in the program, so there are more people finding out about the assistance that's available.
Sure.
And taking advantage of that.
Sure.
Which is a good thing. So there is growth, and so I think long term we need to think about where we want to go with the program and funding. Can we continue to fund at 100%? Because I think the Department of Corrections money, I think, will be addressed in this session, because many of them felt like kind of blindsided that they didn't know it was going in to the Department of Corrections for the Offender Substance Abuse Program, and the money should have been used for Interlock. So I think they're going to try to correct that, and that's how they're going to address it in the supplemental. And we actually got a letter from all four corners of the legislature saying, you know, take it out of your existing budget and we'll give you money back in our supplemental. So much better about, because it was like $2.4 million.
Right.
It's, I feel better about giving it.
Sure.
Out of our budget with that assurance. So I think long term we have to think about how are we going to fund this program and can we sustain 100%.
Is it appropriated through fees?
It is. So the people that go on and are on the Interlock program, Interlock Commission program, they pay a $20 fee. That goes into a revolving account that's available to pay for those that can't afford and meet the criteria.
Sure.
The problem is that we've taken $2.2 million out of that ignition interlock device revolving account and paid it to corrections for their offender substance abuse program, which isn't related to the ignition interlock. But that was a decision that was made, and I'm not sure how. So the concern, I don't think that the Transportation Committee is very happy with the fact that we're spending this money on something that's not related to transportation.
Yeah. Okay.
Do you set the $20 fee, or is that set in the legislature?
It's set in the legislature.
Statute.
Yeah. So we have to figure out whether or not it's going to sustain itself. Because we had already identified that we needed more money because we saw the growth happening. And the governor put it in his budget and they denied it. So we knew it was going to be an issue. And we identified it, but nobody wanted to address it at that time. Now they do.
Any other questions, comments? Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Hey, Erica.
So real quickly, before I get into the DUI campaign stuff, I was asked to let you know that we submitted our 2015 Highway Safety Plan to NHTSA on June 30th. So what that is, this is our plan for the next fiscal year. This just explains all of the grants that we approved for federal fiscal year 15. And then it also establishes our performance measures and goals for our serious injuries and fatalities in Washington. So Darren just asked that we let you know that that's been submitted to NHTSA, and we're still waiting on approval from that, but it's there, and we haven't had any questions yet, so that's always a good sign. You want to add anything to that, Stacy? Okay. So, as you may have heard, we just wrapped up our first summer DUI emphasis patrol, and the big question on everyone's mind is, how are you going to address marijuana? So has everyone seen the DUI ads about drive high, get a DUI, or at least heard the tagline? Everyone's seen those. I know Darren sent out an email that had the YouTube videos on there. So there is a handout in your packet that talks about our schedule for the campaign. You can see the first one that began on June 23rd, and then it just wrapped up on Sunday. So we had our media buyer, Radar Works out of Seattle, worked on this campaign for us, and they decided, because of these new ads, that we really wanted to use our budget for this campaign on our broadcast, so that's TV and radio. And of course, these new ads we were really excited about. They were produced in Colorado, and they used the humor that we like to include for our demographic. So we pushed those out pretty heavily for this campaign, and we also had the scripts that you'll see at the bottom of this page. They rotated those 50-50 on the radio in addition to our drinking and driving the Navigator ad. I'm sure you've heard that one before, with the guy that gets in his car and asks for the best route home, and the navigation device tells him that it's better to get a taxi than try and drive home. So those were the spots that we used for the first flight. And then beginning the middle of next month, we have another, we call it typically our August Drive Sober, Get Pulled Over campaign. That begins August 11th and runs through Labor Day. And in addition to the broadcast, the TV and radio, we are adding in some digital ads. We have banner ads online that'll play, and then also Pandora ads will be playing as well. And they'll be using these radio scripts for Pandora also. So we're pretty excited about that. We've got some good media coverage about the new campaign, Drive High, Get a DUI. We also want to make sure we don't lose any of the drinking and driving messaging either. So we thought it was really important to add that the marijuana component heavily at the beginning of the summer, because of course, as you all know, the stores opened up last week, so we thought it was good timing to get the message out there. And then now we'll kind of try and add the drinking and driving component back in a little bit more for this next campaign. So
We have any data on demographics associated with the most likely folks to use marijuana and drive, or period?
Is it about the same?
It's the same as our drinking and driving demographic.
Okay.
So the men 18 to 34 is that demographic that we're really trying to hit. So that's why we typically like to use the humor angle rather than a finger wag, don't do it. So
right.
Any other questions?
Well, just that.
Erica? Oh. Erica?
Yes.
I have a quick question.
Sure.
I saw the handout you sent out, but I didn't see any links to the ad. Can you send out the links? I'd like to show some folks here.
Yeah, you bet. There's a news on our website. If you want to go there, there's under the featured links, there's a link that has all three of the ads there. But I can go ahead and send out the links as well.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I was just going to say, the most recent data that we have about what's happening with the audience for marijuana and their tendency to smoke and drive, really pointed out that among college-aged and largely men, they were much, much more likely. Like, of those who had used marijuana in the last 30 days, 50% of them had driven after using or been in a vehicle with somebody who had driven after using, compared to alcohol, in which it was like 12%. So, I mean, there's just a, you know, there's just a huge gap in their thoughts around smoking and driving as compared to their thoughts around alcohol and driving.
Right.
So that seems to be a much clearer line for them than marijuana. So we have our work cut out for us.
It's been interesting to see some of the feedback, like Jonna mentioned, on Facebook posts or on news sites, when you see the comments underneath. So many people, it seems like they don't think it's a big deal to smoke marijuana or use marijuana and drive. They don't think that, they don't even know that it's against the law. I had a reporter actually respond to our news release and ask me how much a ticket was for driving high. And, you know, instead, in her mind, she was thinking it was just a
she doesn't correlate
citation.
It with a DUI.
Exactly. So that's why we've been pushing really hard to get that message out there that it's a DUI. You're driving under the influence of a mind-altering substance, and it's against the law.
Yeah, we want to reinforce that with our PIOs in terms of hitting that particular audience as well.
Right.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Jerry.
My name is Jerry Novello. I'm the Target Zero Manager for Thurston County, out of our prosecuting attorney, John Thunheim's office. Here, actually, just a few miles away. For those of you that have printed agendas, you have my handout, but for those of you who don't, I'll pass that around. It's got some basic information about the party intervention patrol that we're doing here in Thurston County, as well as copies of a couple of news articles that were in the news recently. So, I know that all of you are aware of what the PIP program is, but if I could sum it in just a few sentences, I would say that it is the integration of proven strategies used in the chemical dependency profession with ideal law enforcement in terms of contacting underage drinking parties and reducing alcohol and drug use. And the goal is to find underage drinking parties, make sure none of those kids are driving home impaired or with someone who's impaired, and then adding on to that, giving them the tools and trying to change their behavior so that they're not put in those risky scenarios again and reducing their drinking over time. Why we want to do this in Thurston County? Well, last year in 2013, six of our fatalities were with someone who was under 21. And we don't know, you know, how many of those were impaired. But from 2008 to 2012, about 53 of our fatalities in that age group were involving impairment. So it's a high percentage. It's a priority for Thurston County, like it is for the state. We've had the Party Intervention Patrol for 2 years now in Thurston County. As you guys know, Pierce County started it, and having an established program that we could use as a resource for not only the forms and the processes that they've already created, but having live people like Gloria and like some of their law enforcement to call on and say, here's the scenario, what did you guys do, or what do you recommend, or can we come and do a ride-along so we can see the process live from start to finish, has really made our process here in Thurston County a lot smoother than it would have been without that. And so it's been a huge help. They've been very supportive. Over the 2 years so far, we've done 7 patrols from May through July. And of those 7 patrols, we've found parties on 5 of them. We've only been able to get access to 4 of the parties. to process them. The parties have ranged from small house parties with about a dozen kids to large house parties with about 60 kids, which was the case of our recent one in Young, to parties in Capitol Forest, like bonfire parties. They've ranged from out in the woods to more in a more urban setting. In total, there's some stats on the second page of your handout. Those are from just 2013. But in total, including our party this year, 90 youth have been arrested and gone through the process. Of those, 22 were juveniles. So about a quarter of the kids that we come in contact with who have been drinking are under 18. Our kind of primary focus is the juveniles, but we also in Thurston County are seeing, you know, a lot of the 18 to 20 year olds who die in impaired fatalities, and so targeting that whole age range is we think pretty important. And so, regardless of if they're a minor or if they're 18 to 20, they go through the same exact process in terms of the arrest and meeting with a chemical dependency professional, a one-on-one. Even if they're an adult, the priority is to call their parent to come in. If they are, you know, 18, 19, or 20, and they say, no, I'm not calling my parent, but I'll, you know, call my friend, and, you know, we'll do that because they're allowed to. But for the most part, we do bring the parents in, and so they can meet with a chemical dependency professional as well. And both of those responses have been very well with us. In Thurston County, what our patrols look like is we have the State Patrol and the County Sheriff's Office. They are kind of the core group of our patrol. And that is for a few reasons. The biggest reason is that they can fill all of our overtime shifts when we schedule these patrols. If we need three from them, if we need four, they can fill them. Whereas the city departments can't do that as regularly. And to give you an example, our last patrol, we were planning to have Olympia with us, but a week before the patrol, they couldn't fill any of the spots, and our sheriff's office was able to fill those. So we have them with us for that reason, but also it provides some pretty good consistency. So after each party and each patrol that we do, the process becomes more efficient. And I think that's because, one, we have a State Patrol Sergeant, Sergeant Gregerson, who has just been fantastic in leading and training our officers. But we also have familiar faces from the State Patrol and as well as the Sheriff's Office who sign up for these details. And what we've noticed is, you know, you see some people who see that it's a longer shift and, you know, like that overtime, but if they're just in it for the overtime, they don't come back because it's a lot of work. And so we're seeing those officers who believe in the program and are willing to put in the work. And so they come back and you have a more experienced team each time. And then the other reason why we have that core of the State Patrol and the Sheriff's Office is that what we've decided is that regardless of where the party is, so this last one was in the city limits of Yelm, all of those cases go through our county prosecutor's office. So regardless of the juveniles or the adults, just to streamline the process, to make sure that regardless of where the party is, the treatment, as far as the legal process is consistent, they all go through the county, and that's what the Sheriff's Office and State Patrol do as their normal part of their patrols. So having a core of their officers who know what that was like has been really helpful. So as far as this year, we have one more patrol. We decided to do three in the beginning of the summer and then hold off one for just before school starts, so early September, to try to get the word out right as school's starting that this is out there. Now, I can tell you that media is definitely responsive to this program. It's something new. It's something that a lot of people are interested in. And so, they're always calling after we find the party. But what also strikes me is that in the schools, so for one of our parties, it was outside of Tumwater, and there were a lot of students that went to Black Hills High School. And there was, I think, only 15 or so students. However, by Monday, the rumor was that 100 students were arrested by the party intervention patrol. And so, our goal is to, one of our goals is to make sure that the kids know that there's this patrol out there. Every time when we're at a party, parents will come and say something like, "The last time you just called and I picked up my kid and there was no problem." Whereas we're wanting the message to be that there's this patrol out there, that it's not a matter of dispersal. It's they're going to park there, go through the process, and that's what's out there. And we try to give the message that we're out there a lot more than we are. I think that it's pretty effective in terms of at least the perception of our students. Next year, with our increased award, we'll be doing them not only in the summertime, but also throughout the school year. So what my hope is that we'll be able to utilize our school resource officers, which are in many of our high schools, as well as some of our school staff and partners, to identify parties beforehand and to work more in tandem with them during the school year than we have over the summer if they're not in school. We hope to do about 10 next year, which would be an increase from our 4 this year to 10. The other component of this project is reducing alcohol at the source. So one of the sources is stores. And so we've integrated the component of alcohol compliance checks, which it seems like a lot of, at least locally, there's not a budget for that in the regular departments to do those checks. And so with this grant, they're able to at least do one or two of those a year. And most recently, we did one in Tumwater where they checked 30 stores and 40% sold. So we're hoping that, as we do more of these, that you'll see a reduction and at least, cut that source off for the kids. I think our biggest challenge has been finding the parties and knowing where they are ahead of time. We hear from our resource officers, there's a party this weekend, but if we're not scheduled that weekend, then we can't, form a party patrol within a couple days' notice. So there's a lot of moving parts to it that requires pre-scheduling. So I'm hopeful that when we're doing them during the school year, that we can work more together to find the parties on the actual night of where they happen. Our successes, like I've mentioned, we've busted a number of parties, and the impact that you see from the kids and when they meet with the counselor, when the parents meet with the counselor, the feedback that we're getting is that there are some that don't really get into it, but a lot of them, when they're back with the counselors, they know it's confidential. They know that it's just one-on-one, that it is having an impact. And especially with the parents, when they show up, they don't know what to do. They don't know what's available in the community, what they should be doing more with their kids. And then you have someone who's a trained professional in dealing with those situations who can guide them and give them suggestions has been a big relief from their perspective. And we hope to continue to do that in the future. And then I think that we've done a pretty good job here of kind of branding this patrol as the Party Intervention Patrol. Whatever we do, we make sure we're using that language kind of over and over. When we have the group of kids, we're the Party Intervention Patrol. Even though they're in different uniforms, it's the Party Intervention Patrol. So the message that they take to their friends is, party intervention patrol. And we really hope that it can spread where that's kind of a household name with our kids in the community. Did anyone have any questions about what we've done or what we're hoping to do in the future?
Do you coordinate with the Liquor Control Board?
Well, the Liquor Control Board, what we've done with them is the message from their office is they don't have the resources right now to do the compliance checks, but they've sent us a list of stores that have failed in the past. And what we make sure is that all the stores that we check and have sold or not sold, we send those reports to them so they know the stores we've checked and cited.
Sure, are you finding in your instances of arrests any correlation between adults who are supplying alcohol to the youth as well?
Mm-hmm. So part of the investigation at each party is finding out who supplied the alcohol, and that person is arrested. In the most recent one in Yelm, it was a mother who was throwing the party for her son, as well as someone who had 5K, and so they were both arrested for buying alcohol.
So are we trying to heavily publicize those instances to get the word out? Okay, that's good.
And I'll say that as a traffic safety, during the night of, we hear from neighbors that all these kids are leaving before we get there, so you know that some of them are drinking.
Sure.
In Capitol Forest, we've decided this year that we're not targeting that area specifically because we haven't been successful in contacting a party and keeping it contained there in the past. But last year when we went, we pulled over a car that was, he was 16 years old. He was about double the legal limit for an adult. It was a truck, a pickup truck. He had four or five other juveniles in the back who were drunk, going 60, 70 miles an hour through the back roads there, just flopping all around. And so it's kind of instances like that where that at least in this very moment, we are preventing a serious collision or crash during our patrols.
Do you know what the outcome of Good and Bullard were as a result of their providing alcohol, or issuing alcohol? It says they had 34 count. One was arrested for the purchase of the keg, but then the mother was arrested for 34 counts. But what do you know what the actual outcome to her was?
Well, it's still in the legal process of
They're still in prosecution. I mean, those arrests were fairly recent.
So can we be talking to the prosecutors about hitting them pretty hard?
This is our prosecuting attorney. John Tunheim. What do you think, John?
Can we introduce? Because I have teenage kids, and I will tell you that they would tell me stories of parents providing alcohol to their kids, and it was in their own home, they think it's perfectly fine to provide to other kids and so forth. And so it seems like, I think we need to continue to educate kids, but also we need to go, after tougher penalties against parents that are doing this.
Yeah, I agree.
Can you introduce yourself?
I'm John Toon. I'm the county prosecutor here in Thurston County.
Good to have you here.
So nail them.
Hey, Jerry, can you explain how the automatic ID check works? I mean, is it just manually checking to make sure they're not using their own? I mean, if they come up with somebody else's ID, it won't tell them that they're underage. I mean, I guess I'm just trying to think how that's been successful, but how does it work?
So what the State Patrol troopers that are with us, part of their computer system that they have available is they can run each person's name or driver's license. It'll, on their computers, it shows their actual picture. So what we can do is, if they say, I don't have my ID, my name is Joe Smith, and my birthday is whatever, mm-hmm. They can check, and a picture will come up. So then they'll know, okay, that's the right person, we can use that information.
Oh, okay, so it's not something each store, or these stores may have that they use on their own.
What were you referring to something?
Which story was it?
Was it the...
In the news story about the compliance.
Oh, okay. So some stores, most of the newer stores, part of their cash registers, they have some sort of process where they have to go through to make sure the person's 21. It could be you have to enter their birth date.
Oh.
A lot of them have just a driver's license swipe. And in some of our checks, what we see is they'll kind of go around the process or just put in a fake birth date without even asking for ID. And so we try to document all of those to make sure when they're referred to liquor control that they know that they were, in addition to not checking ID, that they were actually putting in fake information.
Gotcha.
Okay. Jerry, is there a network between the counties who have these initiatives ongoing to exchange ideas and information by chance? I know Kittitas County is a strong proponent of party patrols as well. Pierce County, yourselves.
Well, it's our county task force primarily works with this. We kind of worked through me with Gloria and Pierce County to kind of fine-tune our processes.
Sure.
And get advice.
And Chief, we have now, thanks to the commission, we have a little bit of money to put together with their help a documentary on a party intervention patrol out of Pierce County, and then we made a lot of DVDs, training DVDs for the chemical dependency professionals, law enforcement, and so on. So our hope is that every county eventually will develop one of these programs. We just, in the last 6 weeks, have a program in King County that's begun on this very model. And, you're bringing up prosecution. I think that it's fair to say probably that where we see party intervention patrol, and we've been at it for 7 years in Pierce County, we see a lot of prosecution of the suppliers along with the kids. So we are the ones, we are the program that make sure that the officers are trained to be able to bring a case that really is going to be successfully prosecuted, because that is a component of party intervention patrol. We are not just having the parents pick them up and take them home. We want the cases prosecuted. So the more that Target Zero managers across the state or other community entities, foster these programs, the more we will have successful prosecution of adult suppliers and their kids.
So are we finding a central means that they're coming by their false IDs as well?
We haven't
seen
a lot
of that.
Most of the kids are pretty cooperative. Most. Sometimes you'll have one that isn't
sure.
That you can remove from the situation. From that point on, they're pretty cooperative.
Yeah, Pat brings up a good point in terms of liquor control board. It would be great to know where are they getting the bulk of their supply from, so we can target those individuals or places to try and prevent things before they actually happen.
Chief,
yes?
The college age ID, false ID boom is a lot coming out of China.
Yeah.
$200 gets you two IDs.
Yeah, that's been a big problem.
And they're absolutely wonderful IDs, but I'm not sure the bar owners or the doorman down here, but Whatcom County, a lot of the bars are putting a bounty on the false IDs for the doorman.
Mm-hmm.
So each bad ID that they collect is, I think, worth $25 in their pocket from the bar.
Wow.
So the bar owners take a dim view of the false IDs.
Mm-hmm.
And then those get passed on to the liquor board for hopefully further review and some enforcement action from them.
Sure, okay.
So,
yeah, we know the internet has brought about a lot of access. Any other questions, comments? Yes, ma'am.
A comment. I don't know if you know, but Jerry sits in the prosecutor's office in Thurston County. You are the host agency, and I think that's one of the reasons why party intervention patrols is working well in Thurston County. So just a chance to tell you thank you for hosting our Target Zero manager. It's been a great partnership.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we appreciate your efforts in this, because this is a lifesaver. Really helps avoid some of the tragedies around graduation. Mm-hmm. We appreciate it. Thank you. All right, does Stacy want to give a report for Darren?
We're going to defer anything? The director's report until Darren can give one. It's okay. Been largely covered. But is there any questions that you had for Darren that maybe I can address? And anybody?
We introduced Joyce last time.
Yeah.
It's been that long already.
Yeah, just for everyone's knowledge, one of the things that Darren and I have been discussing as of the past week is how can we actually, with our DUI initiative, our Target Zero initiative, is gain more public involvement, make them more aware of what we're experiencing in terms of fatalities overall, and but in particular our DUI fatalities. We need to get their buy-in and their willingness to help us address behavioral issues out there. So such as what we've been doing successfully when we run corridor programs, where we do a lot of heavy emphasis on getting the public's involvement overall statewide. It would be good if we can somehow get our citizens to buy in to trying to help us keep the roadways as safe as possible. The reader boards that we had on 101 in terms of the daily fatality recap, we got tremendous buy-in from the people of the peninsula out in the Port Towns and Port Angeles area. So overall, around the state, in particular communities that we're having some real problems in, it would be good to be able to draw folks into this. And as everyone probably know, in terms of our daily recap of fatalities that are occurring, we're way ahead this year by comparison to last year. So there are some real concerns in terms of now with the legalization of marijuana, the fact that the patrol and other law enforcement agencies are quite short-handed. We're 91 troopers down now on the front line. And even if we had 91 new troopers out there, those are less experienced troopers that it takes time to get them trained in their level of experience up to a veteran trooper to be able to be very, very effective at removing impaired drivers from our roads. So, as I've stated before, we can't arrest our way out of this anyhow. So we really do need to find a way to draw the public in. Any old business that needs to be readdressed? Any new business? Any good of the order? Do I hear a motion to adjourn?
Make a motion to adjourn.
Everybody seconds. Thanks, everybody, for a good meeting. Be safe.